You're listening to FMGRadio.com. Are you ready to take control of your physical, emotional, spiritual, professional, and financial health? Are you ready to experience great success in your life? Each week, join Dr. Diane A. Thompson and her guests for tools and strategies to help you take control of your health and inspire you to live your best life. Now here is your host, Dr. Diane A. Thompson.
Welcome to Health Talk with Dr. Diane, MD. This is a show that is designed to inform and inspire you to a healthier lifestyle. I am your host, Diane A. Thompson, MD, and as always, it is my pleasure spending time with you on this broadcast with the goal that perhaps you may learn something new that could take your health and your life to a higher level. As always, I want to remind you that the information provided on this broadcast is for educational purposes only and is not intended as a source of diagnosis or treatment. Please seek the help of your healthcare provider before making any changes to your health. All right, so I'd like to welcome you back this week. I really appreciate you joining me every week, and it is my goal to bring you continuous great information so that you can continue to grow and learn and be better in life.
Now for today, we have three segments. In segment one, we'll cover what's new in medicine. And this is going to give you the latest information in the world of medical research. And a lot of these findings could affect how your health is managed. The second segment, we'll be talking to the very accomplished and inspirational Dr. Hume Johnson, PhD. And in our third segment, we have a health tip of the week, and this is a healthy cooking tip by way of Georgia Peterson. Now, as a disclaimer, the show is intended for educational purposes only, so the information should not be used as a form of diagnosis or treatment. Now, for what's new in medicine, I have two new studies to report. The first one has to do with growth hormone for fibromyalgia. Now, fibromyalgia is a chronic pain syndrome where patients tend to have widespread pain and multiple tender points. They have fatigue and mood changes and sleep disturbances. And there's no cure for this. This is usually managed with a combination of exercises, medications, as well as psychological support. Now, previous studies have found that about 50% of patients who are diagnosed with fibromyalgia actually have a deficiency in growth hormone. So these researchers wanted to find out, what if we treated patients with growth hormone? Would this improve their fibromyalgia symptoms? Well, they took 120 patients who were diagnosed with fibromyalgia, and they divided them into two groups. One half of these patients received low-dose growth hormone for a full 12 months. The second group received placebo or no real treatment for about 6 months, followed by low-dose growth hormone for the other 6 months. And they checked them at 6 months and then at 12 months. And they found that at 6 months, there were no real differences in the symptoms that they reported. But at 12 months, 53% of patients who received growth hormone for a full 12 months actually had improvement in their pain and tender points compared to 33% of those who received it for only half the time. So the researchers concluded that perhaps growth hormone replacement may be an effective treatment to help reduce pain and improve quality of life in patients with fibromyalgia. And this is really important because this is a difficult and challenging condition to manage, and this may represent another tool to help our patients who suffer from this condition. The second study, and this is another important one because so many of us take aspirin. This study looked at long-term aspirin use, and they found that there is a link with long-term aspirin use and vision loss. Now, many of us take aspirin to protect our hearts. We know that heart attacks have a high risk of death. And so new studies show that people who use aspirin regularly for at least 10 years run a small risk of developing a potentially blinding condition known as age-related macular degeneration. What the researchers did, they looked at 5,000 men and women, and these were people who came in to have their eyes checked, And they followed them over a 20-year period, and they also asked them about their aspirin use. And what they found was that people who took aspirin for 10 years almost doubled their risk for developing macular degeneration, which is a potential cause of blindness. The researchers concluded that there was an association between the two. They didn't think it was a cause-effect relationship. In other words, they didn't think aspirin caused age-related macular degeneration, but there was a positive relationship between the two. So the question is, should you stop taking your aspirin? The researchers felt no. They said for most patients, the benefit of protecting their heart with low-dose aspirin may outweigh the risk of developing age-related macular degeneration. What this information provides, it allows for a conversation between you and your primary care doctor or your cardiologist. So you want to talk to your doctor, make sure if you're taking aspirin that you're getting your eyes examined. You also want to learn what are the signs and symptoms of macular degeneration and ask your doctor what you should be looking for and what you should do if you notice any of those signs and symptoms. So that's it for What's New in Medicine this week. Remember, the goal is to use this information to inform and inspire you to healthy living. And speaking about healthy living and inspiration, I have often told my next guest that she is a source of inspiration for me. And the last time I spoke with her, I said to her, "You are so driven," and she said, "Diane, people have to inhabit their lives and not just exist." And boy, is she a great example of this. Author, broadcast journalist, professor, and political analyst Dr. Hume Johnson is here tonight. Dr. Johnson is an assistant professor of communications at Roger Williams University in Rhode Island. She holds a PhD in political science and public policy, and she studied media communication and has been a top communication specialist in Jamaica for many, many years. She's well published, and her book, Challenges to Civil Society, Popular Protest and Governance in Jamaica, has been well received. Dr. Hume Johnson, welcome to Health Talk with Dr. Diane, MD. How are you?
Thank you, Dr. Diane. I'm very well. Thanks for having me.
As I mentioned earlier, I did say that when I said to you the other day, you're so driven. One of the things you said to me was people need to inhabit their lives and just not exist. How did you come by this philosophy?
Years ago, I love poetry, and years ago I saw this poem. And it was just a line at the time. I think there's a poem now by Donna Markova which talks about I will not die an unlived life. And I'd seen something similar when I was a teenager, and it struck me. And Markova's poem says, "I will not die an unlived life. I will not live in fear of falling or catching fire. I choose to inhabit my days." And it goes on and on. But I remember the line spoke to me, to my soul, and it actually demands that I always remember to live with a sense of purpose and passion. As a matter of fact, I have a tattoo that I put on when I was in Australia, and it says faith and purpose, because I always feel like I need to have a sense of purpose. Otherwise, we get so busy and we live these kind of lives where we don't slow down. There's so much to do, and we pretend to be busy. But if you really stop and in your own quiet time to find out who you are and to live from the essence of your being, then you can develop your sense of purpose. And I think that I developed my own sense of purpose from a very long time, since I was an adolescent. And I decided to live with passion because I didn't want to just exist. I didn't want to just pass through this life. And interestingly, one time, a few years ago, I was on an aircraft heading to Australia. And, you know, this is a very long flight. And I sat beside, I think I was fortunate to have sat beside a psychologist, an American psychologist, who was going down to Australia to give at a conference. And I was telling her how difficult it is to live so far from family. And she said to me, "But do you know that you don't want to miss the experience? you don't want to have this great opportunity in your life and you don't want to miss it. So inhabit it. She used the word inhabit, and it just struck me that this was the second time that it was coming to me, that word inhabit. And when I lived in New Zealand before, my supervisor had said to me one day, you have to surrender to your environment in order to be able to exist. You have to surrender. But I always felt that it was more than just surrendering to living in New Zealand. It was surrendering to life and surrendering to every moment of it. And I think that's what inhabiting means, that you have to occupy your life. It doesn't mean being extraordinarily busy about everything. It means finding a purpose and goals and contributing to humanity in whatever form that you choose. I chose communication and politics and academia and myriad other things. But I do strive to live with a sense of purpose and find my own rhythm.
Oh, that's wonderful. Now, there are people who have been searching for a long time to find their purpose. And I see them. They're doing many different things. And sometimes from the outside, they look so well accomplished, but they're still missing something. How does one go about finding that thing?
Well, you know, I'm not Buddha by any stretch of the imagination.
I don't think you are, but I always find it interesting when someone else has found a way. Maybe they can share that way with us.
But
you know?
As a communicator, and having we exist in this media saturated environment where we're bombarded by commercials and ads and social media, and the opinions of people keep rushing at you, and it creates this mental clutter in your life. And I don't believe that anybody can find their true purpose or live with passion when you're so busy focusing on everything else. Some people can't exist without looking on their Twitter timeline or their Facebook timeline. So one has to come to their own realization by almost slowing down. And slowing down doesn't mean you're not busy, you're not doing stuff. But I believe that your truth or people's truth or their sense of what they're meant to do with their lives, it comes from the quiet of your own company and the quiet of thinking about. And I think this is a perfect time to have this conversation, because every year, at the end of the year, everybody or most everybody tries to make sense of the last year and make a projection for the following year.
Exactly.
It may be short-lived, but at least for a moment, they pause to take stock. I believe the taking stock doesn't have to take place only once per year, but the taking stock has to be constant and consistent, because that's the only way that you actually accomplish the goals that you've set for yourself, is to continue to review them, take stock of them, and make active decisions. So your plans shouldn't be just plans. It shouldn't be just ideas. One has to activate those ideas. And actually, if you're not slowing down to actually focus on certain goals and what you need to do to accomplish those goals, then it would be very difficult to accomplish them.
I wonder, when you were younger, when you pictured yourself as an adult, Hugh Johnson, did you see yourself in this place? Are you where you thought you'd be?
I always knew that I was going to be a powerful voice in my own country and in the conversation that's taking place in my country, because I was always concerned about the community around me. Since I was 14, I took an interest in politics. I took an interest in the community around me. I was part of the Claremont Community Development Action Committee when, before I left high school, in my community,
where,
I was a member
where,
of the...
Where in Jamaica
St. Anne, St. Anne, Claremont,
okay.
St. Anne.
Okay.
I was a member of the police youth club. I was very active in my high school. In fact, I got the prize, among other prizes, Best Community Spirit. when I left high school and throughout university, I was very involved. I became a part of the Prime Minister's Youth Advisory Council when I was 21. And so I've always felt that I was a citizen, and a citizen inside a political community and a social community of people. And so a sense of citizenship has always been part of my projection. So where I am now, I'm not surprised at it. I had not necessarily calculated it, but I knew, I always had a sense that I wanted to contribute to my country in a particular way. And because I was so interested in the conversation which was taking place on the media, I remember listening to radio all the time, that I knew that I would have been a part of that conversation eventually.
Mm. So if you had to say what your legacy would be, what would you say? What would you want your
I think my legacy is going to be one of those who had made a solid contribution to making sense of the myriad challenges that our country confront, and to help to navigate those issues, understand the complexities of it, and to assist the policymakers and the representatives to find direction and to focus on those issues which are the dominant challenges. At some level, it's not just thinking about it, because I'm involved with it as well. And so actively, I think that even the notion of Brand Jamaica is very important for me as a citizen of Jamaica. And Jamaica's had a very bad reputation in some respects. And I think part of my contribution will be to try to get the diasporic community and the global community to see Jamaica as a really progressive society. And I think that my political efforts, my academic efforts have all begun to position Jamaica in that way. And I think that is going to be my solid contribution, I believe.
Let's talk a little bit about your book, Challenges to Civil Society, Popular Protests and Governance in Jamaica. What made you decide to take on the task of writing this book?
When I was at university, I was involved in my own fair share of of student protests and demonstrations. And there's a lot of things to protest about in Jamaica. There's crime and violence, violence in schools, murder of children. We have a certain level of intolerance for differences sometimes. We have sexually explicit lyrics sometimes. We have lyrics that incite murder in our music. And so at the same time, we have low levels of citizen participation. So despite over 5,000 community-based organizations in Jamaica, there are still low levels of engagement. Recent surveys say that 80% of our citizens say that they don't trust each other. And so we have low levels of trust among citizens and low levels of social capital. And so I wondered how we dealt with the issues that plague us, how citizens dealt with it. And so I had a genuine curiosity about the types and nature of political expression. And when I was a journalist, I had witnessed firsthand the gas riots of 1999. And so these expressions of protest that was coming from the base of society, I wanted to find out how the marginalized could better organize themselves to call attention to their concerns, what kind of tactics they employ, what is the character of these activities, and whether or not these activities were representing the building of a genuine civil society, or was it really hindering our progress in this regard. And so this was the reason for penning this book. I think that civil society has not been effectively and adequately discussed in Jamaica. The official organs of civil society, the church, various lobby groups, the media, community-based organizations, they have been
dormant in a sense, sedate in many respects. And so the citizens have felt the need to engage in looser networks of street protests rather than lobby groups representing their interests. And so unfortunately we have evolved in a way, and I mean our society has been based on political rebellion against slavery and colonialism, and so there's a bit of continuity where that is concerned. But we're no longer living under a colonial system, and so the successive governments have been much more open than clearly in the colonial past to the citizen concerns. And so there was a problematic that we need to resolve, whether or not we should be protesting in this way. And I concluded that there is a way that they feel that they won't get attention unless they're protesting in this way. But at some point, the protest has to move from the streets to the political negotiating table, because that's where the real issues will be resolved and policy taken in the interest of citizens.
So for the reader of this book, what is the most important piece of information you'd want them to take away?
I want them to not, especially people who are looking at Jamaica from the outside and when we're ready to tear down the place, I want them to understand. I want them to understand why Jamaicans protest. Jamaicans are responding to the many faces of poverty, declining social conditions and quality of life, feelings of injustice. They feel that there is inadequate supply of collective goods that they're entitled to, roads, transportation, the cost of utilities. And there's political insensitivity as well, poor representation. They have a feeling of political exclusion and neglect of connection and conversation with their political representatives. And so that abandonment of contact and dealings with the political cause. That feeling of injustice is not just injustice from the civil and or criminal justice via the courts. That is also a concern. But they're concerned about those desirable goals that every human should want in their society: drinking water, housing, proper roads. And if they civil treatment by the police, let me add that, and if they feel that they're not getting this, then they will protest in the ways that they do in Jamaica. What we're trying to say, though, is that this kind and model of protest is not necessarily empowering, and it may not get them the results that they genuinely desire.
Okay. Now, I happen to view the pictures of your book launch that occurred in Jamaica. Sorry, I couldn't be there. And one of the things I was struck by, so many dignitaries were there. I saw two former prime ministers, many members of parliament, and I wondered, how did you build such relationships?
Maybe the book was just fascinating.
Maybe that's what it was.
when I was 20, as I was telling you, I was recruited to the Prime Minister's Youth Advisory Council, which was the Prime Minister was then the Honorable P.J. Patterson. And so my relationship with him began at that point. Over time, my contributions to the political scene as a speechwriter in the Ministry of Security. I've done research work for political organizations on both sides. My presence in the Jamaican media as a reporter and afterwards as a political analyst does give me a kind of presence. And the book itself, though, the topic is so relevant and will always be relevant. And P.J. Patterson is very interested in civil society and in building a genuine civil society. And so the content of this book really resonated with him. My own relationship with other prime ministers, I don't know them very well, but the leader of the opposition, he was invited and he thought it was it was a great conversation to have begun.
the talk about civil society, and so he made himself available. Some of the other persons that you saw there were friends who respected me, or persons who I've worked with in the past who wanted to lend their support to the event.
So my last question, what's next on the agenda for you?
Well, I do want to write about crisis communication, or communicating in crisis in Jamaica. I think a lot of the issues that we have could be resolved, particularly at the political level, if representatives knew how to communicate when something is wrong. I think there's a tendency in the culture to be secretive, and I don't think we practice open and transparent governance. And even though we live in a more in an information age, where politicians have access to the media and there's greater opportunities to make contact with the political class, I don't think many of the organizations know how to effectively communicate with citizens, and we're not accustomed to involving them. That inclusive governance is not as entrenched as it should be. And so when there's a crisis, there's a problematic in terms of giving information, answering questions. And so I have begun work on a book, Communicating in Crisis, and I also wish to do another one more specific to media relations.
That's the next project, and we'll look out for that. Please tell our listeners how they will get a hold of your book.
Well, Challenges to Civil Society is available on Amazon.com. It's also available from the publishers, Cambria Press New York. And for those people in Jamaica, it's available at the University of the West Indies Bookshop in the Mona campus.
Dr. Hume Johnson, I really want to thank you so much for sharing some information with us. I really appreciate you being on our show.
Thank you so much, Dr. Diane. This was nice having to be on our
program.
All right.
You take good care. And now on to our health tip of the week. And this health tip is coming by way of Ms. Georgia Peterson of Georgia's Shared Delights. You can find this on Facebook. I consider Georgia to be a creator of food. And if you don't believe me, go on her site and you will see. Georgia, welcome to Health Talk with Dr. Diane. What's your tip for us today?
Thanks for inviting me, Dr. Diane. The tip for today will help you reduce the fat content of a recipe when baking. You can reduce fat by replacing butter, oil, or margarine with applesauce.
Applesauce?
Yes, applesauce. Oil, butter, margarine may add flavor and moisture to your product, but they also increase the fat level. Replace your butter with unsweetened applesauce. For example, 1 cup of applesauce to 1 cup of butter. Instead of adding butter, use applesauce. Or if you still want some flavor from the butter, you can use 1/4 cup of butter to 3/4 cups of applesauce. Not only will you have your product fat-free, but it will also be still moist.
And it will taste the same.
It will taste the same. The texture might change a little, but as you experiment, you will get the perfect baked product. Just add your applesauce to the liquid, whether the milk, the egg, mixed out. Don't overbeat. This might cause it to get hard and reduce your cooking time by about 25% from, say, 60 minutes to 45 minutes. Experiment. Enjoy. Quick breads, bundt cakes, muffins, cookies. That's your tip for today.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Georgia Peterson. I really appreciate that health tip of the week.
You're welcome, Dr. Diane.
Take care.
Okay, bye.
That's it for us this evening. It's been a jam-packed evening, and thank you so much for listening to Health Talk with Dr. Diane, MD. As always, strive to be happy, healthy, and wise. Thank my guests for coming on the show. Take care.
You've been listening to Health Talk with Dr. Diane, MD. For show replays and full guest bios, please be sure to visit fmgradio.com/Dr. Diane, MD. That's DrDiane, MD.